Benny Rothman, A Fighter for the Right to Roam, Workers' Rights and Socialism, 2016, written and compiled by Mark Metcalf on behalf of the Unite Education Department. The contents to this book are a foreword by Jim Mort, the Director of Education. Chapter 1, Jewish Working Class Upbringing. Chapter 2, The Great Outdoors. Chapter 3, Becoming a Communist. Chapter 4, The Kinder Scout Mass Trespass. Chapter 5, Fighting Fascism. Chapter 6, Finding Work and Becoming Active in the Amalgamated Engineering Union. Chapter 7, Metro Vix. Chapter 8, Immense Political Activity. And Chapter 9, Recognition Comes at Last. What you're about to hear is a Unite the Union education booklet. Benny Rothman, A Fighter for the Right to Roam, Workers' Rights and Socialism. It was written by Mark Metcalf. The foreword to the book was done by Jim Mort. Welcome to number 5 in a series of short books on great men and women who feature prominently in the history of Unite and its predecessor unions. Our hope is that publishing these histories will provide not only fascinating reading, but inspire the current and future generations of trade unionists to take up the struggle on behalf of working people. There is certainly a lot to fight for. We are facing a difficult future in which the division between rich and poor is growing ever wider. The constant attacks on trade unionists, both in Britain, Ireland and abroad, are expected to intensify. Education has therefore to be viewed in the context of equipping members to understand and fight back. Additionally, as part of Unite the Union's three pillars strategy of organising, international solidarity and politics, the Education Department is enthusing our members to write their own stories and explore their own family and local histories. To that end, we have established on our website Rebel Road an inventory of trade union and labour movement heroes who are publicly recognised in the form of a plaque, mural or statue, or even a pub named after them. Please have a look and consider contributing. It is in this context that we are producing these booklets, and it's a delight to feature a man who was a determined lifelong fighter for the right to roam, workers' rights and socialism. Benny Rothman is, of course, best known for the major part he played in the historic mass trespass over Kinder Scout in April 1932. It is universally accepted that this paved the way for the 1949 National Parks and Access to the Countryside Act, and ultimately the Right to Roam Countryside and Rights of Way Act of 2000. So many articles, books, radio and television programmes have appeared on Kinder Scout that you could end up thinking that Benny did little else with his life. But as his son Harry makes clear in this book, he rarely spoke for many years about 1932. That is because he was so busy fighting for his class. And what a fight he put up. He was forced by poverty to leave school and find work at an early age. His bicycle then took him out into the countryside in his spare time, and following which he later became secretary of the Lancashire branch of the British Workers' Sports Federation and began organising outdoor activities amongst local young people. In an era where the replacement of the Tsar in Russia by a new system based on the common ownership of the means of production appeared to offer the working class the opportunity to rule and an end to exploitation, Benny then joined the Communist Party of Great Britain. Benny's release from prison following the trespass saw him pitched into the battle around Manchester against Moseley's fascist black shirts. As secretary of the Cheetham branch of the Young Communist League, he organised hundreds of local youngsters, including many from the Jewish community in which he grew up, to physically oppose Moseley whenever he appeared locally. It was a struggle the anti-fascists won handsomely. On finally being able to find employment as a fitter at Metro Vix, Benny soon found himself elected as an Amalgamated Engineering Union, the AEU, shop steward. And during the Second World War, he found himself representing nearly 2,000 workers on the Works Committee. Benny managed to increase the pay rates and fully supported women who found they were being paid below the rate for the job. Any incidents of racism were also successfully tackled. However, in 1941, Benny was victimised by management for his trade union activities. and although the section in which he worked took 8 days of supportive strike action, he found himself again out of work. He began work at Cairns Richards in 1956 and worked there until he retired in 1976. He performed nearly every trade union role possible and also became secretary of the area-wide Broadheath Shop Stewards Forum that provided leadership in struggles against rising levels of unemployment and attacks on trade union activities. In retirement, Benny, despite his obvious knowledge that capitalism was not going to be replaced in his lifetime, remained a pocket-sized dynamo. He was involved with support groups on behalf of the mainly immigrant Grunwick strikers in the 70s and the miners when they attempted to save their jobs and communities in 1984-85. He backed many environmental groups such as the Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. I personally knew and worked with Benny in the mid-70s when he was the secretary of the Altrincham Trades Council in Manchester and I led for the Transport and General Workers Union on Liverpool Trades Council. He, with Jack Askins, was inspirational and he was a lovely man. Benny continued to go rambling and media work became important to Benny in finding the widest possible audience for the cause of access to the countryside. Even after he became confined to a wheelchair, he responded to requests for interviews and it was a sad day when he died in January 2002. You've just been listening to the foreword by Jim Mort to the book Benny Rathman, A Fighter for the Right to Roam, Workers' Rights and Socialism. Chapter 1. Jewish Working Class Upbringing. Bernard Benny Rothman was born on the 1st of June 1911 in Granton Street, Hightown, Manchester. His parents, Isaac and Fanny, were forced to leave their home country of Romania because Jews were the target of religious persecution, anti-Semitism and racism. Isaac initially emigrated to New York, but after working as a sea steward, he settled in Manchester in 1908. Its Jewish community was expanding significantly at the time. In 1875, it was estimated at between 7 and 10,000, around a third of which were from Eastern Europe. By 1929, there were 33,000 Jews in Manchester and Salford. By 1939, this had increased to 37,500. Isaac worked as a stallholder at Glossop and Shaw markets, where he sold ironmongery such as clothes, pegs, knives, forks and candles. He was agnostic, but was active in Manchester's Jewish societies. More religiously minded than her husband, Fanny Solomon was very literate and could read and write in English, Yiddish and Romanian. These skills meant that she was often asked to read and write letters by members of the large Jewish emigrant community where she lived with her parents in the Cheetham area of Manchester. After she married, Fanny would sometimes assist on the stalls, but was reluctant to do so on the Sabbath. Fanny had two sisters, Laura, a machinist and dressmaker, whose husband was an amateur religious scholar, and Etty, a tailoress, painter and great reader, who later introduced Benny to the works of Upton Sinclair and Robert Tressel's working-class classic, The Ragged-Trousered Philanthropists, which he found of great interest. Her brother Arthur, Jack Solomon, was for a few years the national treasurer of the Independent Labour Party and a friend of Jimmy Maxton. He lived in Ireland and as a clothing worker there had been involved in a big clothing worker strike with revolutionary socialist James Connolly, one of the martyred leaders of the 1916 Easter Uprising against Britain's rule of the country. Hightown was all cobbled streets, and Benny reminisced that the only grass he knew as a boy was that growing between the cobbled stones. The small local park on Elizabeth Street was packed with children running about. At weekends, Benny, often with his sisters and or some friends, would frequently walk 3 miles to Heaton Park, where he could enjoy roaming through the parkland. Benny was the third of five children, the others being Phyllis, Lee, Rose and Gerson, in that order. His father died when Benny was 12. The loss of his income meant Phyllis and Lee left school immediately, and whilst the former worked from home, Lee worked for a strange ways draper's firm for many years. The sisters assisted on the stalls, and Benny's uncle looked after the youngest children on Fridays and Saturdays, while his mother and sisters were at the two Glossop stalls, the Shaw stall having been given up. The income was poor, and Benny's mother's inexperience in buying, plus her refusal to seek outside help, meant this was a difficult period for the family. Benny had attended St. John's School in Elm Street, as well as a Hebrew school that ensured he could read some Hebrew. His teacher encouraged reading at home, but Benny's family could not afford a suggested children's weekly newspaper. Despite the hardships he experienced, Benny won a scholarship to Manchester Central High School for boys. He made significant academic progress and was also good enough in the gym to ensure he participated in the school's gym display during Manchester Civic Week. This was despite the family being unable to provide him with the right equipment. However, in return for his mother witnessing of a neighbour's will, the latter used a rich cousin to help find Benny a job with Tom Garner's Motor Company on Peter Street, Manchester. Despite his disappointment at having to leave school so early, Benny, even after a heavy dressing down from his headmaster, understood there was no alternative as he was needed to help his widowed mother support the rest of the family. This work did not meet with the approval of his extended family, who felt that if he must work at such an early age, it should be in clothing, a traditional Jewish trade characterised by small workshops and factories. Clothing and furniture making industries were to be hit hard by the economic depression of the 1920s and 30s, and, like many other workers in Lancashire, the Jewish working class communities of Cheetham and Strangeways were to suffer great hardship. It was amidst this dismal economic climate that Sir Oswald Mosley launched the British Union of Fascists in Manchester in 1932. Benny was to be one of its most active opponents. Chapter 2 of Benny Rothman, A Fighter for the Right to Roam, Workers' Rights and Socialism. The Great Outdoors. For the first couple of years at Garner's, the youngster was an errand boy collecting spare parts from the motor factories. Going to work on the tram was expensive, and it also took a long time. Benny asked his grandmother if she would pay for a bike, and he was given £4. A sympathetic contact at one of the shops that he called on during his errands agreed to build him a bike out of spare parts, whilst a wheel builder made him a pair of everlasting wheels. The bike was heavy and unwieldy, and on his first outing, Benny fell off several times. In addition, his family felt that using the bike wasn't respectable. Notwithstanding this, he continued to ride it to work. In the book, there is a photograph of Benny as a youngster with his bicycle. The bike gave Benny his first taste of the outdoors. He knew almost nothing about the area beyond his local community, and when he cycled to Knutsford, he returned disappointed after not seeing any nuts. There were also no nuts at Knott End near Blackpool, but it was there that Benny had his first camping experience when he slept in a shed with two young goats. Later he began his long association with what became his beloved Peak District. He rode to Hayfield and walked on from there, leaving his bike with some friendly calf owner or local resident. Taking a tent with him, Benny had his first bike holiday when he cycled to North Wales, sleeping the first night at Prestatyn in someone's back garden. When a local farmer learned that Benny intended climbing Snowdon alone, he arranged for an older man to accompany him. However, waking up early in the morning and finding no one around, he assumed his guide had left him and so left to make his own way up the mountain. Armed with a cheap Woolworths guide, Benny made his way up the Penwygurrod footpath to reach the summit of Snowdon and celebrate his 16th birthday there. He had seen no one during his ascent. On a beautiful day, Benny was bowled over by that first magnificent view over Snowdon across to the sea. This became an enduring memory for him. The next place he visited was the Lake District, where he found that many local people were helpful, allowing him to sleep in their barns or leave his bike with them for a few days. He climbed Scarfell Pike. On occasions he camped wild, thus ensuring a cheap week's holiday. Benny fancied becoming a motor salesman, a flashy job at the time. In 1927, he started a night school course in salesmanship and advertising, also studying economics and economic geography at the Peter Street YMCA. What you're listening to is chapter 3 of the booklet, Benny Rothman, A Fighter for the Right to Roam, Workers' Rights and Socialism. It's entitled Becoming a Communist. At work, Benny often found himself in discussions with his workmates. An ex-seaman, Bill Dunn, a Communist Party member, learned that he was studying and provoked arguments with him in which Benny was left floundering. Benny was invited to attend what he believed was an economics talk, but in fact turned out to be a meeting of the Young Communist League, which, after some hesitation, he joined. The YCL had been founded in 1921, although it had organisational independence from the Communist Party of Great Britain, the CPGB, which began life in 1920. The Young Communist League remained under the party's political direction, as it was viewed as a recruiting school for future adult member activists. Bill took Benny to a number of Sunday night forums at local venues, including the Clarion Club on Market Street. Benny learned a great deal from the speakers, some from the Socialist Party of Great Britain, the SPGB, some from the Independent Labour Party, and more rarely from the Communist Party of Great Britain. A regular income allowed Benny to buy a second-hand lightweight bicycle. He joined the local Clarion Cycling Club that was originally formed as the Socialist Cycling Club in 1894, where he soon became the Minutes Secretary and began going on Sunday club outings. Benny never felt entirely comfortable within the Clarion Cycling Club, the membership of which he regarded as right-wing Labour. As a consequence, he preferred to ramble and camp with his workmates and friends from Cheetham, visiting Millersdale, Disley and other places surrounding Manchester. In 1931, when Benny heard of efforts to set up a British Workers' Sports Federation section in the Manchester area, he joined and he swiftly became the Lancashire branch secretary. The British Workers' Sports Federation had been established in 1923 by the National Clarion Cycling Club, Labour Party sympathisers and trade union officials and activists. However, from the late 20s onwards, the British Workers' Sports Federation became increasingly influenced by the Communist Party of Great Britain, which saw it as a means of recruiting working class, particularly young people, to communism through sport. Many of the young people who were attracted to the British Workers' Sports Federation, especially in Manchester and East London, were Jewish, with the organisation being a major provider of sport and recreation to young second-generation Jews. During the interwar years, these youngsters were moving away from the culture, religion and authority of their elders, and this general weakening of ethnic and communal cohesion increased the levels of assimilation amongst young British-born Jews. In 1929, the Jewish Chronicle claimed that an estranged generation of younger Jews existed within the population. Sport played a major role in drawing Jewish youngsters away from immigrant society and helped them integrate into the indigenous working class. The British Workers' Sports Federation and the Communist Party of Great Britain was key to these developments. However, the domination of the British Workers' Sports Federation by the CPGB led to other socialist groups leaving to form a less radical body called the National Workers' Sports Association. Benny, like most members, got involved with the BWSF because he wanted to provide opportunities for outdoor activities amongst local young people and to strengthen existing connections between the cycling world, the campers and ramblers across the Manchester area. Although it did promote football, it even led a campaign in 1931 for Sunday League football, it was much more strongly associated with walking, cycling and camping, as the organisation was designed to be a vehicle for Labour sport and aimed to promote international fraternity and substitute the spirit of sport for the spirit of militarism. The BWS participated in the first summer International Workers' Olympiad in Frankfurt in 1925. Workers' Olympiads were viewed as an alternative event to the Olympic Games, which were seen by Labour and Socialist organisations as being too elitist, sexist and racist. Vienna staged the second Summer Olympiad in 1931 and Antwerp the third in 1937, when plans for the event to be held in Barcelona had to be abandoned because of the ongoing Spanish Civil War. Because of his Clarion connections, Benny was asked by the BWSF to select the cyclists who would go on a sporting delegation to the Soviet Union in 1931. Benny decided to organise an open 25-mile trial, which attracted considerable publicity for what he later declared was one of the most open competitions of its kind in the country. Sid Harris and a crewman named Taylor won, and both went to Moscow, although in the event the cycling race was not on the roads, but on a wooden dirt track more like a wall of death. Consequently, the British team captain, motorcyclist Clem Daredevil Beckett, who had taken his dirt track bike to the Soviet Union, competed until the track collapsed. Benny raided BWSF funds to hire tents and other equipment and organised rambles and lively camps at weekends in Disley, Marple and Roath. This introduced 50 to 60 working class people of all ages to the outdoors. The campfire sing songs were particularly popular. In late 1929, Benny was eagerly looking forward to the launch on New Year's Day 1930 of the CPGB's new daily newspaper, The Daily Worker. The newspaper aimed to report and interpret working class life and lead the struggle. Its banner heading was Workers of the World Unite. Benny chalked on the pavement near Piccadilly Station that people should look out for the new paper. Despite an attempt by a passing member of the public, who happened to be the Manchester CPGB organiser Frank Bright, to argue that he committed no crime, Benny was arrested by a police officer. He was charged with obstruction and later fined 7 shillings and 6 pence, 37.5 pence to day. His conviction was widely reported in the local papers and went down badly at his workplace, where he was doing quite well, having been placed in charge of a small department dealing with all the guarantees when new cars broke down. Benny, many years later, remarked, "I certainly blotted my copybook." According to Benny's son Harry, "My dad liked working in the garage and he was offered promotion as he was good at doing his job. He turned down the offer, which was one of a number he received during his working life, including one as a personnel manager. But he was not like many other socialists and opportunists who used the struggle to personally advance themselves." When the Daily Worker first appeared, Benny sold 50 to 60 copies a day in the first week. On the 3rd of January, the paper included an article on capitalist sport is rotten, and the following day there was a lengthy piece on Russian working women build socialism and overcome evil legacies of Tsarism. Women readers in London were urged to write to women in Soviet Russia. Later in the month, the paper attacked the Labour government, police and magistrates for the jailing of two militants from Cardiff who had been arrested and imprisoned for obstruction at a meeting held by Welsh seamen in support of striking seamen in London. In the same edition, there was an uncritical, highly laudatory article on Joseph Stalin, the then leader of the Soviet Union, who was described as a steadfast Bolshevik, agitator, organiser and military leader who carried on the life work of Lenin. In 1932, textile workers across East Lancashire took strike action and battled in the face of international competition to save their jobs and industry. The Daily Worker provided extensive coverage and mercilessly criticised trade union officials for what they felt was an unwillingness to organise all-out strike action and, if necessary, take over and run the factories without the employers. The newspaper was seen by the rich and powerful as posing a direct challenge to the capitalist system. Those who saw the paper could point to what had happened in the Soviet Union, where the Tsar had been overthrown in 1917 and capitalism was being replaced by socialism. Poverty, unemployment and alienation were being eradicated. Although it sold well at first, Benny soon found that sales declined. He felt this was probably because it didn't address the concerns of most people. He did manage to sell a few at the garage, but clearly most of the customers were from the better-off sections of the community, whilst the managers were generally hostile. There was a low trade union density amongst the workforce, with only two other people being openly identified as trade unionists. Bill Dunn was one, and the other was a turner called Whitworth. Years later, Benny discovered a third undercover member. Attempts to get all the workers to enrol as trade unionists were unsuccessful, and when Garners later merged with Roots, this allowed the new company to rationalise by dispensing with many workers, including Benny Rothman, with the young communist being one of the first to go. The Kinder Scout mass trespass. This was pretty much the extent of Benny's involvement in politics prior to the Kinder Scout mass trespass of 1932. It is for this which he is internationally known and which he covered in his 1932 Kinder Scout Mass Trespass book, first published in 1982. The protest played a significant part in the ultimately successful campaign for public access to moors and mountains. To celebrate the 70th anniversary of the trespass, writer Rowley Smith, who was the current vice president of the Outdoor Writers and Photographers Guild, wrote the following piece in 2002, in which Unite is grateful for allowing to be republished here. "Forgive us our trespasses. Sunday, April 24th, 1932, dawned fine and clear, a perfect day for enjoying that away from it all, top of the world feeling, uniquely and so easily available to ramblers on the high moorland of Kinder Scout. But 70 years ago, the highest and wildest moorland of the peak remained frustratingly out of bounds to the growing army of walkers who had joined the huge rambling craze in the surrounding cities. Only a dozen footpaths of 2 miles or more crossed the open moorland of the Peak District, and not one crossed the 15 square miles of the Rambler's Holy Grail, the 2,000-foot summit of the Kinder Scout Plateau. Britain was then bumping along the bottom of the depths of an abysmal depression, and nothing that Ramsay MacDonald's Labour government could do seemed to help. Dole queues stretched in the streets of Manchester and Sheffield, and the newspapers were full of reports of demonstrations by the unemployed as the jobless total topped 3 million. The great escape offered by the misty, inviting moors of the peak, just a sixpenny, 2.5 pence today bus ride away from the grimy back-to-back terraces, was a magnetic temptation, a chance to recreate in the true sense of the word. Many were prepared to risk an encounter with the burly gamekeepers, who jealously guarded the moors for their grouse-shooting masters. Trespassing had become a popular sport, adding an extra frisson of excitement to a moorland ramble. G.H.B. Ward, the king of the Sheffield Clarion Ramblers, had dubbed the pastime the gentle art of trespass and gained the new dubious distinction in 1923 of having a writ served on him, making him apologise for past trespasses on Kinder and promise not to trespass again. But the gamekeepers are not always there, he gleefully reported in the 1952-53 Clarion Handbook. And after a while, the amount of general trespassing did not decrease. He regarded the writ as a greater honour than an OBE and added, may Kinder be free in 1953, and may those who never knew this fight for liberty deserve the victory by their use of and behaviour on Kinder Scout. It was against this kind of background that the famous mass trespass on Kinder Scout took place. There can be no doubt now that the trespass was politically motivated, but it was born out of a mounting sense of frustration felt by many young outdoor people at the apparent lack of progress made by the rambling establishment towards the long-standing goal of obtaining free access to Britain's mountains and moorland. A goal now within sight after the recent passing of the Countryside and Rights of Way Act. Intellectuals like Professor C.E.M. Jord and Professor G.M. Trevelyan appeared to support the idea of trespass. Jord, addressing a Ramblers rally in the Winnets, Castleton, had told his audience, if you want the moors to be free, you must free them for yourselves. Most interpreted that as an invitation to trespass, although George later denied this. The rambling federations of Manchester and Sheffield were opposed to the use of direct action. Both Harold Wild of the Manchester Federation and Stephen Morton of the Sheffield Group went on record as saying that they believed the trespass had put back the access campaign by 20 years. It came at a time when they genuinely believed they were at last beginning to break the power of the landowners by getting them to agree to meet around the conference table. Access campaigner Tom Stevenson, while opposing the tactic of mass trespass, thought this was nonsense. The cynical emasculation in Parliament of the 1939 Creake-Jones Access to Mountain Bills showed how little reasonable hope there was for access legislation at the time. Stevenson acknowledged that the 1932 mass trespass was the most dramatic incident in the long access campaign. He said, though, it contributed little, if anything, to it. Edward Royce, Access Secretary of the Manchester Federation and a leading champion of the Access cause, was equally dismissive. The year 1932 will not be remembered as a red letter year for the Rambler, he wrote soon afterwards. It has been a period of more than the usual froth and bubble. Royce's successor as Access Secretary was Philip Daly, later to become National Chairman of the Ramblers Association and Chairman of the Access and Footpaths Committee of the Peak District National Park Authority for 19 years. As such, he was closely involved in the negotiations for the first access agreements with the landowners in the Peak, and said he found the mass trespass was invariably used as an argument against public access. Such access as we have gained, he wrote, owes nothing whatever to the mass trespass. And I can say quite categorically, without fear of contradiction, that the mass trespass was a positive hindrance and deterrent to the discussion and negotiations to secure the freedom of the hills. The idea of a mass trespass originated during the Easter 1932 weekend camp of the communist-inspired British Workers' Sports Federation held at Rowth on the western edge of Kinder Scout. A visiting group of London-based British Workers' Sports Federation walkers had been turned back by abusive and threatening gamekeepers at Yellow Slacks on the western approach to Bleaklow from Glossop. Back at the campsite, it was agreed that if enough ramblers had been there, no number of keepers could have turned them back. We decided there and then to prove the point, recalled Benny Rothman, then secretary of the Lancashire District of the British Workers' Sports Federation. Which was why that sunny Sunday morning found Rothman, then a 20-year-old unemployed motor mechanic, and his best friend Wolfie Winnick, cycling out of Manchester to the friendly village of Hayfield, which shelters under the western ramparts of Kinder Scout. They were already wanted men, having used their bicycles to avoid police waiting at Manchester's London Road station with a restraining injunction against the event, which had been deliberately well publicised by Rothman in the Manchester newspapers. The bells of St Matthew's Georgian Parish Church were ringing out as Benny and Wolfie planned the event, which was to change the course of rambling history, over a cup of tea in the village tea room. What happened next is now firmly established as part of rambling folklore. The march of about 400 ramblers from Hayfield Recreation Ground to Borden Bridge Quarry, where a plaque unveiled on the 50th anniversary now commemorates the event. The impromptu speech by Rothman when the main speaker failed to arrive. The joyful arm-in-arm singing procession up the Kinder Road by Nab Brow above the reservoir and into William Clough. And the sudden breakout onto the forbidden ground of Sandy Hayes at the prearranged signal of three blasts on Wolfie's whistle. Tom Stevenson always insisted that the trespassers never reached the summit of Kinder Scout, which is 2 miles away and about 400 feet higher, and the available evidence seems to bear him out. Rothman himself said that the body of ramblers was about halfway up William Clough on the Hayfield Snake Inn public footpath, which had been negotiated by the Hayfield and Kinder Scout Ancient Footpaths Association as long ago as 1897, when the trespass actually began. At Wolfie's signal, they started to scramble up the steep slopes of Sandy Hayes in open formation. A line of between 20 and 30 keepers was waiting for them on the brow of the hill. The few undistinguished scuffles which followed resulted in one temporary keeper, Edward Beavers, being knocked to the ground, injuring an ankle. Press photographs taken at the time actually show concerned ramblers coming to his assistance. John Watson, one of the group of stick-wheeling keepers waiting on Sandy Hayes, said afterwards, "We could hear them cheering and yelling as if they had achieved something when they achieved nothing at all. They'd only trespassed about 100 yards. They never got halfway up the Clough." Rothman later agreed with Stevenson that the so-called victory meeting, when the Hayfield group met up with others from Sheffield who had come by the much more difficult route across Kinder's peaty plateau from Edale, was held near Aesop Head, at least 2 miles northwest of Kinder's hard-to-find summit. But in the end, what was more important was that they had trespassed in such a public and positive way, rather than how far they had trespassed. The trespassers agreed that they would march back to Hayfield with their heads held high and not dispersed like a band of criminals. It was a demonstration for the rights of ordinary people to walk on land stolen from them in earlier times, Rothman was to write later. We were proud of our effort and proudly marched back the way we had come. The police, who had declined to take part in the scramble up Kinder's steep flanks, were waiting in a line across Kinder Road when the trespassers returned. Five people were arrested, in addition to John Anderson, a rambler actually opposed to the trespass, who had just come along to see what would happen, but was apparently arrested when he went to assist the injured Beavers. They were variously charged with public order offences such as riotous assembly, but significantly not with trespass. The story of the trial of the trespassers at Derby Assizes is as riddled with the same kind of class prejudice as the rest of the event. The judge, Sir Edward Acton, was true to the best traditions of English justice. When it was revealed that a copy of a book by Lennon had been found in the possession of one of the accused, Tonner Gillett, when he had been arrested, Sir Edward Acton innocently inquired, to the merriment of the court, "Isn't that the Russian gentleman?" Rothman's self-conducted defence, prepared in the darkness of a Leicestershire prison cell, was a masterpiece of open-air working-class rhetoric. "We ramblers, after a hard week's work in smoky towns and cities, go out rambling for relaxation, a breath of fresh air, a little sunshine," he told the court. "But we find when we go out that the finest rambling country is closed to us just because certain individuals wish to shoot for about 10 days a year." Ironically, it was the severity of the sentences handed down by the judge on the five young defendants, ranging between 2 and 6 months imprisonment, which was to unite the ramblers' cause. John Anderson received the longest sentence for assaulting the gamekeeper, a charge he disputed to the end of his life, and one which Derbyshire's chief constable publicly stated in 1994 he was innocent of. Even those implacably opposed to the trespass were appalled by the savage sentences, and the Manchester Federation were among many who appealed to the Home Secretary for a remission. A writer in the Manchester Guardian compared the affair to a university student rag, pointing out that people arrested during rags were not usually sent to prison. The Clarion Handbook of 1933-34 reported that the stiff sentences handed out did not bring laurels to the other side, and thousands of ramblers were reported to have gone to view the scene of the trespass immediately after the event. The booklet shows a photograph of the 1932 Jacob's Ladder protest meeting against the prison sentences handed out to the trespassers. Jude Clines is speaking, Tony Gillett seen sitting with his head in his hand. They had both been jailed for 2 months. Benny Rothman is not in the picture as he's still in jail. The annual Ramblers Access demonstration in the Winnets a few weeks after the sentences were handed out drew a record 10,000 people, and further mass trespassers followed at Abbey Brook in the Upper Derwent and on Stanage Edge, but significantly no arrests were made. Indisputably, the mass trespass on Kinder in 1932 brought the access issue to a head and acted as an important catalyst to the whole National Parks and Access to the Countryside campaign, which eventually led to legislation in 1949. When the Peak District National Park Authority came into being in April 1951, it lost no time in addressing the access problem. And it was no accident that the first ever access agreement allowing walkers the freedom to roam was signed just a year later, covering 5,780 acres of Kinder Scout and Broadleaf Bank Tor. Today, more than 80 square miles of moorland are covered by such agreements. The Right to Roam Countryside and Rights of Way Act of 2000 can be seen as the crowning culmination of the efforts of these brave pioneering trespassers, though few will live to see its enactment. There can be little doubt either that the Kinder trespass has entered the realms of mythology of the outdoor movement, giving its few survivors a totally unsought aura of martyrdom. Rowley Smith. Who else attended the trespass? Jimmy Miller was there. He's better known as Ewan McCall, the singer who wrote and recorded the Manchester Rambler. McCall later married Peggy Seeger. Also there was A.G. Paik Taylor, who in 1932 was a Manchester University lecturer and who later became a distinguished historian. Clem Daredevil Beckett, the man who rode the Wall of Death on his motorbike, was also on the mass trespass. Benny Rathman is of course best and widely known for the mass trespass, yet according to his son Harry, "My dad barely mentioned it as he always had too much on. He knew it was important, but he was engaged in things that were immediately important, such as trade union and Communist Party work." Although Benny had not chosen to go to prison, he did utilise his time there productively by learning shorthand. This was to prove a very useful skill when he became a workplace union representative, allowing him to constantly challenge management when they changed their attitudes during negotiations and sought a dispute they had previously concluded an agreement. Chapter 5. Fighting Fascism. When Benny came out of prison, the continuing high levels of unemployment meant he could not find work locally, as the negative publicity also meant he was blacklisted. The Young Communist League proposed, and he agreed to go to Burnley with Ernie Regan, an Openshaw lad of Irish extraction. where the pair would be involved in the struggle across North East Lancashire by clothing workers who were on a prolonged strike against the Moore loom system. The aim was to build a YCL group, but this proved almost impossible as any previous organisation had become defunct. Benny found the poverty in Burnley to be much worse than in the Manchester area. Interviewed years later, he recalled a young married man in his early 20s. The couple were living in a little terraced house and had a table, but only one chair and a couple of boxes to sit on. They may have had one or two cups, but they were living in abject poverty. His wife was expecting a baby, and he went to the hospital to arrange for her to go into hospital to have the baby. He was told she could only go in when she went into labour. At what point they thought she was going into labour, and they rang for an ambulance, but were told they had to make their way to hospital on their own. They set off to the hospital, which was at the top of a long hill. As they were walking the last lap, she collapsed on the pavement. A tram driver stopped his tram and took the couple as near as possible to the hospital. The baby was lost, and the tram driver got into very serious trouble for doing what he did because he had breached regulations. "That was an indication of the atmosphere at the time," said Benny. Attempts to get young people from the mills into a political movement floundered as meetings were very poorly attended. More successful was the establishment of a Sunday Football League, but when the footballing authorities said they would exclude any football team who played in it from the ordinary normal competitions, then this broke up. It was also possible to get a small rambling club started, but these were no consolation for the failure to build a political organisation. Benny returned to Cheetham after 4 to 5 months away, stating later, "I wasn't cut out for what I've been asked to do, as I wasn't previously that much involved directly in politics." On his return home, he helped resurrect the Cheetham Young Communist League branch in 1933 and became its first secretary. This was to become one of the two largest YCL branches in the country, the other being in another large Jewish area, Stepney. Later in the year, Benny helped set up the Challenge Club on Herbert Street, Cheetham. Challenge was the name of the YCL paper. The club, which eventually shared a healthy number of its 400-plus members and facilities with Cheetham YCL branch, offered an impressive range of activities including rambling, cycling, a boxing club, gymnastics, and even Sunday evening dances that, because of its amplified music, became very popular with local young people. The club was to become the hub of anti-fascist activities in Manchester over the next few years. Meanwhile, the act of combining social with political activity meant the YCL branch grew to over 200, dwarfing the local CPGB membership itself, which was less than double figures. Such growth failed to prevent Benny being criticised, with his opponents fiercely arguing he was not engaging in political but social activity. A former Conservative MP, Sir Oswald Mosley, had been a minister in the Labour government of 1929-31, but, inspired by Benito Mussolini in Italy, he helped found the British Union of Fascists in October 1932. Taking advantage of the desperate economic climate right across Lancashire, Mosley aimed to make Manchester an important centre of his activities. He blamed the depression on minorities, including Jews and left-wing and communist movements, rather than on the capitalist system. He was successful in obtaining the backing of the Daily Mail owner Lord Rothermere, and at one point the BUF claimed to have 50,000 members, corps of black-shirted paramilitary stewards, nicknamed the Black Shirts. Fascism became visible in Britain at the same time as Adolf Hitler began to consolidate power in Germany after he became Chancellor on the 30th of January 1933. He then eliminated all political opposition en route to becoming dictator of Germany. In Manchester, the BUF set up its headquarters in the Northumberland Street and Tyson Street areas, where many Jewish people lived. According to Benny, the BUF drew their membership from lots of unemployed people who got a uniform and a club where they could box. There was a lot of anti-Semitism at the time. Adopted a policy of deliberate provocation of the Jews, visiting the Jewish quarter to make insulting remarks, which led to outbreaks of disorder. The Jewish Chronicle of the 24th of July 1936 reported how fascists had appeared outside a Cheetham cinema that was frequented by many Jewish people and began selling their newspaper Action while shouting out, "The only paper in the country not financed by Jews." Faced with such intimidation, Benny helped organise local opposition. The battles with Mosley's black shirts started when they tried to go into Cheetham and were driven out by the YCL. We eventually made it impossible for them to hold an event. At one meeting in Marshallcroft, we turned their van over, and at any event they organised, we turned up and heckled. On one occasion, I was arrested, but the charge was later dropped. However, the fascists were able to hold weekly meetings in other parts of Manchester, and they distributed literature door-to-door that sought to divide the working class on religious and ethnic lines. 18 new BUF branches were established locally in 1933 and 1934. The largest BUF activities were mass meetings and rallies, which were designed to demonstrate its invisibility to its opponents and potential supporters. A large rally was held on the 12th of March 1933 at the Manchester Free Trade Hall, and a further Manchester City Centre BUF meeting was held on the 29th of October 1933. Benny Rothman was amongst the anti-fascists who physically opposed both meetings. At the former, he was very fortunate when the event erupted into fighting between the fascists and anti-fascists, who were mainly communists, and he was shoved over a balcony, only escaping serious injury when his fall was broken by a fascist sitting below. Fascism was meanwhile gaining significant political support and interest. The following day, the 30th of October 1933, the Daily Mail editorial was headed 11 Years of Italian Fascism. It concluded, "Rome was not built in a day, and fascism, though nominally 11 years old, has its roots in the best of Italian civilization." It is interesting that the Duce, Benito Mussolini, in his message on Saturday, still emphasised the severity of his task before fascism. Whether this revolution is the world's word of command and hope has yet to be proved. What will Europe be like at the end of the century? Then on the 31st of October 1933, the Daily Mirror carried an article reporting the comment of the Nottingham Lord Mayor, Mr. H. Seeley Whitby, headed "We Need a Hitler," in which the Lord Mayor hoped for a man with the energy and initiative of Hitler and Mussolini. At Bellevue on the 29th of September 1934, Mosley picked up on Hitler's attacks on Jews by telling the audience that his opposition was financed by Jewish financiers who had stabbed our men in the back when they were fighting in the last war. This event, though, proved to be a failure for the British Union of Fascists. Article, reproduced thanks to Searchlight magazine, entitled "Bye Bye Blackshirt, Oswald Mosley Defeated at Bellevue" by Michael Wolfe. After the notorious brutality of the fascist meeting earlier in 1934, Mosley thought he would have a repeat performance in Manchester. To combat this threat, an anti-fascist coordinating committee was created to counter the fascist thugs. A dynamic campaign of leafleting, flyposting and public meetings were organised to mobilise the opposition. Deputations were organised representing the broadest possible democratic coalition to demand the banning of the fascist meeting. In the face of all the protests, the meeting was allowed, and to add insult to injury, the chief constable banned all marches, a decision clearly taken to make anti-fascist mobilisation more difficult. However, the anti-fascists were determined that there would be no repeat of fascist violence and intimidation. Saturday, 29th of September. The opposition mobilised. Three marches from Openshaw, Mills Platting and Cheetham marched to meet the hundreds already waiting to meet them at Ardwick Green to form a united demonstration of over 3,000 people who would march along Hyde Road to join the protest meeting outside Bellevue. The contingent from Cheetham comprised in the main young working class Jewish activists from the Challenge Club, the Youth Front Against War and Fascism and the Young Communist League. Together they formed the backbone of the group that was to rout the fascists later in the day. When the marchers arrived at Bellevue, they were greeted by the hundreds already assembled for the protest meeting. The marchers, however, had not come to listen to speeches. They'd come to stop Mosley. At the agreed time, they left the meeting, crossed the road, and in orderly fashion queued up to pay their entrance fee for Bellevue. Once inside the amusement park, scouting parties tried to find the fascists. They had no success, as these examples of the master race were hiding in the halls hired for them. Mosley was to speak from the gallery, which was protected by the lake. His supporters were to assemble on the open-air dance floor, which was in front of the lake. Even so, the fascist leader did not feel safe, and in addition to the gang of thugs he called his bodyguard, there were wooden barriers in the place. In case this was not enough, searchlights were available to be directed against the anti-fascists and fire engines with water can at the ready. The scene was set. 500 black shirts marched from a hall under the gallery and formed up military style. Mosley, Apin, Mussolini stepped forward to the microphone to speak. He was greeted by a wall of sound that completely drowned his speech. Down with fascism, down with the black shirt thugs. The rats, clear out the rats. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we want Mosley dead or alive. There were anti-fascist songs, the Red Flag and the International. The sound never stopped for over an hour. In spite of the powerful amplifiers turned up to maximum, Mosley could not be heard. To quote the Manchester Guardian, sitting in the midst of Oswald's personal bodyguard within 3 yards of where he was speaking, you could barely catch 2 consecutive sentences. Mosley tried all the theatrical tricks he knew to try and make an impression, but without any effective sound he appeared like a demented marionette. Defeat stared at him in the face and he knew it, as did his audience, which slunk away as soon as the police bodyguard was removed. The humiliation of the fascists was complete. The only sound they could now hear was the singing of Bye Bye Blackshirt to the tune of Bye Bye Blackbird, a popular song of the time. With the fascists defeated and demoralised, the protesters raised their banners and posters high and proudly rejoined the meeting outside Bellevue. Mosley's humiliation was complete. What was supposed to have been his most important meeting since Olympia was in fact the first of a series of defeats he was to suffer in Manchester. Chapter 6. Finding work and becoming active in the Amalgamated Engineering Union. On the employment front, matters improved as Benny found work again preparing cars. His son, Harry, explains, "My dad was a fitter. He never did a formal apprenticeship, but he was one of those people who could copy others just by watching them. He was a very quick learner who could have walked into university nowadays." Benny, now working again, joined the Amalgamated Engineering Union, AEU for short. But there was only one other employee at work who was a member, and that was the foreman. Nevertheless, Benny began to get himself involved at a minor level within the EU by becoming the Minutes Secretary for the Manchester 2 branch, and from which he was elected as a delegate to the Manchester and Salford Trades Council. The secretary of this was A.A. Purcell, who Benny described later as a great character. Purcell was heading towards the end of his life, but he had sat as a Labour MP in the House of Commons on 2 occasions and was president of the International Federation of Trade Unions from 1924 to 1928. However, when Benny realised that he could do far more for his working class movement by working in a factory, he managed with some difficulty to get work at a Newton Heath aircraft factory called Avro. Benny was later sacked for unknown reasons by Avro when they found out that he was a communist. The Communist Party of Great Britain, CPGB. The CPGB was formed in 1920 with the aim of establishing a communist society based on the common ownership of the means of production, whereby the surplus product, the excess of products and services necessary to maintain everyone at a decent standard of living, is retained by the labouring class rather than under capitalism, where it belongs to the ruling class in the form of profit. 3 years earlier, in 1917, the Russian or Bolshevik Revolution overthrew the oppressive Tsarist autocracy, and then, with Vladimir Lenin at its head, the Bolshevik Party replaced the provisional government with a new form of rule based on Soviets, workers' councils, through which the working class would rule. In the aftermath, all of Russia's banks were nationalised, with private bank accounts confiscated, whilst all foreign debts were repudiated. The Bolsheviks, through the Communist International, which they had founded in 1919, made it apparent that they hoped and wanted similar revolutions to occur right across the world. In reaction, 8 foreign nations, including the UK, military-backed anti-communist forces known collectively as the White Armies, but which were later defeated in a civil war lasting several years. Success in Russia generated enthusiasm in Britain, and the CPGB was formed from the merger of smaller socialist parties, with the aim of replicating what Lenin and the Bolsheviks had achieved. From the beginning, one of the major contested issues was parliamentarism and what attitude the party should have to the Labour Party. Initially, it was agreed to work with the assisting reformist trade unions and Labour, but after the latter refused to allow the CPGB to affiliate as an organisation, then any CPG members who joined Labour did so as individuals. During the 1920s, the CPGB maintained a policy that it should only consist of revolutionary cadres prepared to fight capitalism and, by doing so, demonstrate to an increasingly desperate, often starving working class that the only organisation that could lead it out of its misery was the CPGB. Membership and influence amongst militants, particularly in mining communities, grew, and then, in 1929, a new class-against-class policy was adopted after the 1928 Communist International Congress declared that this was an era of economic collapse, in the wake of which there would be mass working-class radicalisation, which, with communist leadership, could lead to proletarian revolution worldwide. This new line meant that from now on, social democratic parties were viewed as being as much a threat as the openly capitalist parties such as the Conservatives, as well as the emerging fascist parties such as those led by Mussolini in Italy and Hitler in Germany. In turn, fascism and with it the suppression of all forms of democracy were seen by the CPGB as tools that the ruling class in capitalist liberal democracies would turn to as a last resort in their battle to keep power. Class against class meant that the CPGB became not only viewed as an enemy by the ruling class, but also by many in the Labour Party and trade unions who found themselves wrongly dubbed social fascist. The situation facing many CPG members at work became hostile, and many were victimised and put out of work. Even after the CPGB abandoned class against class after Hitler came to power and adopted a Popular Front policy of trying to forge alliances with Labour, and even some openly capitalist parties, the bad feelings generated earlier meant that despite CPG members being at the forefront of struggles, especially around unemployment and Spain, they continued to face an uncomfortable time from progressive fellow workers angered at being mislabeled in the past. Meanwhile, the capitalist press continued to warn of the red menace to help defend a system still racked with high levels of unemployment, poverty and low levels of welfare provision. Happily married. Before he's lost his job at Avro, Benny met and later married at Christmas 1937 fellow communist Lillian Crabtree. Lily's mum, Maria Doyle, was Irish and her dad, Paul Crabtree, a moulder and lifelong socialist, was from Lancashire. Lily was a cardroom worker in Rochdale's cotton mills. Over the years, she also worked in numerous jobs. She calculated 19 in all, including engineering, asbestos manufacturing, cooking at school, housekeeper to middle-class ladies who found work too hard, and as a carer for several people. In the 1930s, she often found herself the sole working member of her family. Lily was an active trade unionist and shop steward herself within the General and Municipal Workers' Union and the Transport and General Workers' Union. She finally retired just 2 years before she died, just 6 months before her husband's death, at age 86. She was from a family of 13, of whom only 8 survived childhood. Before Lily was born, her family had been forced to go into the workhouse, where one of her sisters contracted meningitis and died. Her eldest brother, Tom, was crippled fighting in World War I. Two other siblings escaped poverty by emigrating to Australia, and another moved south to work on the railways in Oxford. In order to earn some money, some of Lily's brothers boxed at semi-professional level. Harry Rothman recalls, "We used to visit Rochdale on the bus from Manchester's Stevenson Square, and in the mill towns you saw these great big chimneys that steeplejack and TV personality Fred Diner later blew up. They were everywhere. It's hard to imagine it now." Lily's family have found about her marriage to a Jewish man, admittedly not one who was in any sense religious. By contrast, Benny's mother and family were deeply unhappy that he'd married outside their faith and did not attend the marriage ceremony, making clear that from then on he was not welcome at home and they did not want to see him again. As a consequence, his brother Gersh and his uncle Arthur were the only family members to maintain contact with him over the next 2 decades. Sadly, Lily's mother Maria also did not make it to the wedding as she died a couple of days before the big day. Originally, the newly married couple lived in Fieldsworth, but in 1938, as their first baby Harry, born the 19th of July 1938, was due, they were able to move to the recently constructed Ridings estate in Timperley near Altrincham. It was wonderful for them to get out of that dark, industrial terraced housing into a semi-detached house with a garden, explains Harry. The couple, who had a second child when Marion was born on the 14th of December 1940, were to spend almost 60 years living in the house, which they eventually bought. Chapter 7 of the Unite Education Booklet of 2016 on Benny Rothman by Mark Metcalf, which is titled A Fighter for the Right to Roam, Workers' Rights and Socialism, Metro Vicks. Following his Avro dismissal, Benny was able to get a job at engineering giant Metropolitan Vicks, Metro Vicks, which was eager to recruit skilled labour as Britain began to gear itself up for war with Germany. Benny found that whilst there were a number of Communist Party members at the company, they were not very active. By this time there was a growing drive for assistance to Spain, where a rebellion against the democratically elected Republican government had been organised by General Franco, with armed backing and military support from Mussolini and Hitler. The fear was that a Franco victory might further encourage Hitler and Mussolini to spread their poisonous regimes by invading other parts of Europe and Africa. In response, thousands of volunteers from across the globe went as part of the international brigades to help defend the Spanish Republic. Getting there was difficult because whilst Germany and Italy ignored the non-intervention agreement signed in January 1937, the Conservative government in Britain banned volunteers from going to Spain. Anyone caught going from Britain to Spain to fight fascism faced the possibility of imprisonment. At least 2,500 British men and women fought for the Spanish Republic, and many had a strong trade union background, including the later TGWU General Secretary Jack Jones, who served with distinction in Spain between 1936 and 1938 when he was repatriated after being seriously wounded at the Battle of Ebro. Jones said, "Since the governments of the world, governments like Britain and France, were not prepared to go to Spain's aid and were standing on the sidelines, we felt that it was right to give whatever help we could in supporting them." Others who volunteered to fight in Spain include Tom Jones, who later became the Welsh TGWU General Secretary, and whose tale is told in issue 1 of this series of books. At an Aid for Spain gathering in the Manchester Free Trade Hall, Benny volunteered as a driver. His offer was refused as he was not an experienced driver, would not have been able to handle ambulances and buses over the mountain passes. Benny threw himself into raising money and support for Spain, but could not do so openly at work, where he also had to be careful about selling the daily worker. He got himself heavily involved in arguing, particularly with Labour Party members, after Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain returned from discussions in Munich with Hitler in September 1938, declaring peace in our time. Opponents of the deal argued that by appeasing Hitler, it would simply inspire him to expand his military capabilities and make war even more certain in the future. Supporters of the deal believed that by allowing Germany's annexation of parts of Czechoslovakia, then Germany would be content and not seek further expansion. Ultimately, critics of the deal were proved right, as within a year, the world was at war. One of the most prominent critics of appeasement was Communist MP Willie Gallagher, who had opposed the First World War, but was aware what dangers the working class faced with fascism. Benny believed that much more should have been done to get support against Hitler, and that as a result, Britain entered the war much less prepared than it should have been. When war broke out in September 1939, however, he was heavily criticised at work because a month earlier, the leader of the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin, had signed a non-aggression pact with Nazi Germany. This committed each country not to aid each other's enemies or to engage in hostile acts against one another. Many communists in Western Europe were outraged at Stalin's actions and quit the party in disgust. But Stalin needed a breathing space to build up his armed forces that had been severely damaged by the purges he had conducted against important military leaders. At the same time, the two states agreed to partition Poland between them, with Germany taking by far the larger part. There were atrocities in both parts of Poland, although those committed by Hitler's Nazis far exceeded anything elsewhere. The pact was broken, though, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union on the 22nd of June 1941, a move that ultimately proved crucial in the German dictator's defeat. Benny, who by now was also in the Home Guard, became an elected shop steward at his department within Metro Vicks, and he helped set up a Timperley AUE branch, of which he became one of the first officials. He was becoming more and more involved in trade union work at factory, branch and later district level. Metro Vicks was one of the leading organised trade union workplaces in Britain, if not in Europe. The Works Committee was very long-standing, and a lot of officials in the union at the time were either elected or selected from among the workers at Metro Vicks. Later, these included Hugh Scanlon, who subsequently became the AEU president, Ellis Smith, Norman Atkinson, Stan Orme, Frank Arlwin, and Fred Lee, later all Labour MPs. The Labour Party wanted its MPs to have been workers then. Metro Vicks was in reality a conglomerate of factories, and the Works Committee had about 15 or 20 delegates on it that each represented a department. Just before World War II started, Benny became the delegate from Westworks Switchgear, where 800 to 900 people worked. As there was also a new factory there to work on radio work, and he also represented that group, which was 1,000 strong, then he was representing nearly 2,000 workers on the Works Committee. Most departments, however, 300 to 400 strong. During the war, there was also a Women's Works Committee, as so many were imported, particularly from the Northeast. The women were as equally well organised as the men.